This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is you can.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help you break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity mate, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. I know I often say I'm excited, but yes. I am very excited for this one.
Yes.
We've got an expert investor, probably the expert investor in Australia at the moment, and I can't wait to pick his brains.
It is our absolute pleasure to welcome Hamish Douglas to the show. Hamish, welcome.
Bryce, it's great being with you guys. And Alec, hi. You know, I've been looking forward to this. I'm a big fan of what Equity Mates has been doing and its growing audience. So looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you. For those of you who are unaware of who Hamish is the chairman, CIO and lead portfolio manager at Magellan Financial Group, a fund manager he co-founded with Chris McKay in 2006. Hamish is, in our opinion, the best investor in Australia today, and amongst everything else is a fellow podcaster hosting Magellan's In The Know podcast. So a bit of a competitor, but that's okay. We'll let that slide. to kick off today,
We're not a competitor, but thanks for the plug. Very
no, it is a very good podcast. If anyone out there has finished all the episodes of Equity Mates, would recommend giving In The Know a listen.
As always, we like to start with a game, Hamish, that is overrated or underrated, which, Ren, you want to kick it off?
Sure. So we'll start at home with our major index. Overrated or underrated, the ASX 200?
Yeah, I'll quickly play the game. But first of all, I'd say you have to take a multi-year view. I've got no idea in the next 6 months, okay? I'm an equity guy. ASX 200, underrated.
Nice. The NASDAQ 100, overrated or underrated?
Oh, definitely underrated if you take a view over time.
We suspected you would say as much. Wall Street Bets has been in the news a lot lately after the GameStop saga. Underrated or overrated, the impact of Wall Street Bets?
I would actually say underrated over time. I think this is a big movement. You know, I believe in the wisdom of crowds. You have to also be careful about the foolishness of crowds as well, but it's bringing mass audiences to looking at issues in markets. And, you know, and you may underrate the effect. And, of course, there's been huge noise around it at the moment, but I think this is here to stay, and underrated, I would put it.
Yeah, nice. Underrated or overrated, the Australian property market?
Australian property, I'd say, is overrated at the end of the day. I'm an equity guy, but it's a bet on low interest rates at the end of the day. You know, it's an illiquid asset class. It's got a very high transactional cost, but residential property has been going up at probably twice the rate of average wages growth for 20 years. And ultimately, that's a disconnect. And the reason it is because interest rates have kept falling, and interest rates are now at their all-time record levels. So property is just a bet on interest rates staying low. So I'd put in the overrated category.
And then finally, Hamish, we've got to ask, overrated or underrated Bitcoin?
Overrated. overrated. Probably some of your audience think they may switch off at this point.
I'm out.
Yeah, I think Bryce will switch off.
Overrated, I would say. You're running ultimately a very large central bank risk here. I know exactly what's going on. It's the classic wisdom of crowds issue. Amazing underlying technology and the theory behind it going on. But if it becomes too large, there's a very large risk that one of the major central banks will effectively outlaw it. Mm. They don't want it becoming a dominant part of transactional activity in the economy. It's not traceable. It's not with the central banks. The central banks ultimately will want digital currency sitting in their purview. And, you know, if the US bans Bitcoin at some point in the future, this thing will go to zero. And, you know, the question is, can you be smart enough to outguess when that event will happen? Mm. It keeps going up. There's a huge crowd effect in it. The underlying technology is incredible and theory behind it's incredible. But I just think it's a very, very dangerous place to play. And good luck to people.
Good luck.
Good luck. So, Hamish, we love to hear the story of people's first investments. We generally find there's a good lesson or a good story that comes out of it. So, to kick us off today, can you tell us the story of your first investment?
Yeah, I'm going to be a little bit cute here because my first investment is probably not the great one. It's my second investment. But I will tell you my first, and then maybe the second one actually has a little bit more lessons. My first investment was at university. It was just after, it was in October 1987, and people have studied markets. October 1987 was a pretty famous point in history where the stock market crashed. And just after the stock market crash, I, without doing any research or understanding much about equities, ended up buying Elders, which was controlled by John Elliott that became Foster's. I ended up making a little bit of money, but I wouldn't call it an investment. It was just markets had crashed and I had a little bit of money saved up and I put some money into Elders. So I call that just dumb investing. My first real investment was probably back in 1991 when I just had started work, when I'd actually accumulated a little bit of money. You know, I was paid $36,000 a year when I started. So, and that was working in an investment bank. How things have changed. Jeez. Even adjusted for inflation, people are paid a lot more today. And I invested in a company called the Franked Income Fund. And people may not remember this, but the Franked Income Fund was a entity that effectively had a controlling shareholding in a company called Wesfarmers that people may have heard with. And I thought Wesfarmers was a fabulous business, and we had a series of businesses and were compounding capital at very attractive rates, but you could get into Wesfarmers at maybe a 30% discount by buying this holding company that sat above it, which was the old Farmers Cooperative. And I love the underlying Wesfarmers business, and I thought if I could buy in at a discount, and I put all my net worth into this at the time, I've actually still got all my Wesfarmers shares. And the theory I had is I love the underlying business, but ultimately because of this value gap sitting there, that the Franked Income Fund would be wound up in the end. And then you would get a double gain. I thought Wesfarmers was trading at a discount to its value, and then I was buying at a 30% discount into a discounted value in a long-term business. And I put, for me at the time, a meaningful amount of money. And believe it or not, I've still got all the Wesfarmers shares.
Wow.
I think I've probably compounded my capital since 1991 at 20% per annum by going in there and just holding it for a long duration. So the lesson there is compound returns and duration really matter. And probably when you see something that looks like a layup, you shouldn't hold back. It's a Charlie Munger sort of thing. You know, at the end of the day, where something's just staring you in the face and it's and there's a double discount into it, and you think the business is really high quality, you know, those are the times you should strike. And I learned that lesson pretty early on, and it's been a very, very favorable experience. I actually think my average entry price into Wesfarmers, I know it is negative. Dividends would be substantial. I'm getting more dividends per share than I paid for the original shares, but they returned all the capital.
Wow.
So I got all my capital just given back, and I've got these shares that are worth millions of dollars now that are paying me a lot of dividends every year, and I got all my money back.
Well,
I was very lucky. I got that lesson early on. You know, this was the second year I started working.
Yeah. Well, we just did an episode on the power of compounding, so it is perfect timing that you are following up with one of the biggest lessons for you is, understanding that power of compounding.
Yeah, Bryce, compounding is a super important term. And one of my favorite quotes is from one of the founding fathers of America, Benjamin Franklin. And Ben Franklin said, money makes money, and the money that money makes makes more money.
Mm,
mm. And that's what compounding is all about, putting away some money today and let that money work for you over time. And my investment in the Franked Income Fund was just such a great example of what sort of 30 years can do for you.
Mm. Yeah,
it's been a fun ride.
Well, Hamish, I think you get the prize for the best story of the first or second investment that we've heard so far. And I think for our listeners, that
the
gives
first
you...
was a bit of a dud, I have to say.
I'm pretty sure someone said their first investment was a goat. But anyway,
I think that gives everyone a flavor of what's to come in this interview. You know, you've got a very impressive track record. But before we get into what you're doing at Magellan today, we're just going to take a quick pause and hear a word from our sponsors.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
So Hamish, as I just said before the break, Magellan has made a name for itself investing in some of the best businesses in the world and has an incredible track record as a result. Alphabet, Microsoft, Facebook, Starbucks, chief amongst them. Tech is obviously a very interesting space for a lot of our audience. How are you thinking about some of these tech giants like the Alphabets and the Facebooks of the world going into the 2020s?
It's a very, very good question, Alec. First of all, I'd say that these companies, particularly ones you're mentioning, you said Alphabet, Microsoft, Facebook, they are some of the most extraordinary business models that you've ever seen in capitalism. In terms of the market share that these companies have in their segments, they're near monopolies, and they've got very, very powerful network effects around their businesses. And of course, that's going to attract the regulators when you get near monopolies. So we could talk about regulatory risk in these investors. So first of all, you're just in an extraordinary rarefied air in terms of history. And I also describe these business models as sort of capitalism without capital. Normally, the very dominant firms of history have got to their domination by having huge capital-intensive business models. If you look at the railways, if you look at what happened in Standard Oil when they got broken up, if you look what happened in AT&T and then it got broken up, very, very capital-intensive businesses. But these businesses, because they're digital networks, can kind of expand with no incremental capital. It's just extraordinary what can happen. And you've asked your question, sort of what is the outlook for these companies for the 2020s, which is a very good way to frame it. On Microsoft, you know, it's really about the ongoing digitalization of enterprises in the world. You know, they have the largest software as a service known as SaaS in the world, and the SaaS space is on fire. But Office 365, so when you think about Office with Outlook and Word and Excel and others, it's now effectively available over the internet, stored in the cloud, and they're adding more and more functionality to that all the time. And they've got hundreds of millions of subscribers if you add up enterprise and individuals there, and it's a subscription service. And now you're thinking of Teams. We're on Zoom at the moment, but they own a video platform called Teams, and they're deeply integrating collaboration on Teams. And then if you think about also digitalization, it's about the cloud. And they are one of the four hyperscale cloud players in the world with the Azure platform. And they're in an absolute sweet spot for the 2020s, both in the SaaS space, in digitalization, and their cloud infrastructure business. And a few other players in that space, by the way, but they're in an absolute sweet spot At the moment, it's our largest investment. We bought in 2014 Microsoft at $28 a share when it was deeply out of love. $28 a share, we made it our largest investment. And you know, to that, 6 years later, it's $250 a share. You know, and we've been paid lots of dividends along the way as well. And we still hold it because we still think it's got enormous runway. So this is going to be probably at least a 15-year investment we will hold, which comes back to the original thing I was talking about, Wes Farmers. If you can find these things and sit on your ass and if they can grow and compound. You know, Microsoft is very large. I think it's the second largest company by market cap in the world after Apple at the moment. And it is compounding its revenues at 15% a year at the moment, which is just mind-blowingly extraordinarily. Alphabet, again, it's got a near monopoly in Western search. And what is driving search is what I'd say is the digitalization of commerce in the world. So you've got a massive tailwind behind. You may think sort of their advertising business is mature, but if you're a business and you're now wanting to change your business model and you're wanting to connect with consumers who are online, you're literally going to have to advertise and go in the top of the funnel with search. There are a few competitors in that space, but the advertising industry is now consolidated down to very few players. The traditional advertisers are dead and there's a long runway. And then localization is a very important thing, connecting local businesses to people who have a mobile phone and they know where you are and they're going to know so much about those businesses, and the connections of connecting consumers in their physical presence to that local business is a huge opportunity. And then they've got emerging businesses. They've got a cloud business called Google Cloud that is just like the Azure business at Microsoft that's losing a lot of money but has enormous potential. YouTube, of course, is you guys will understand this. You're on YouTube as well. It's a very, very powerful business. It's still in very early stages of its monetization. Augmented and virtual reality in the future, AI, quantum computing, and then you've got autonomous cars. So there are so many aspects of Alphabet. It's just not the 2020s. It's probably the 2030s. It's just simply one of the most advantaged companies on the planet. Facebook is the third one. It's a slightly narrower, to be honest. It's not quite the breadth there. It's much more just an advertising business. But even their advertising businesses, Instagram hasn't been fully monetized, and their messaging platforms, Messenger and WhatsApp, haven't been monetized at all at the moment. And of course, as a social network, they're very, very dominant. But I would say slightly narrower business model than Alphabet and Microsoft is.
We got blocked from Facebook this morning, though, after these new rules have come in, you know, with the news and whatnot with the Australian government. Facebook have clumped us into the section of, I guess, a news outlet, and we can no longer speak to our audience through Facebook. So, damn them.
Yeah, I've got a sympathy for the Australian government around the importance of media here. I'm not sure I fully agree with the way the government's been attacking it, and you know, Google and Facebook are responding in different ways to that legislation. And I don't fundamentally blame Facebook either about their decision. You know, these are complex issues and they're making choices, and I think it's just unfortunate.
So, Hamish, you just spoke about the outlook for some of those big companies, especially Microsoft and Alphabet, you know, with incredible growth potential, it seems, in the future. There are a few risks that are on the horizon around antitrust regulation or increased regulation in the States. There's some talk from some fund managers around digital decolonization, where you know, those US big tech companies are being challenged by local tech companies. How do you think about some of these challenges for the big tech companies going into the next decade?
Yeah, decolonization is just another simple word for competition.
But
it's localized competition against them. But decolonization is a much fancier term. It's much more intellectual to use that word than local competition. At the end of the day, it really depends how advanced the development is of those digital markets in those various economies around the world. Is there a chance where the game's still being played out, where effectively local competitors could either be sponsored in Russia or India or Brazil or wherever this may be and create business models? I would say in search, it's probably the game's been played out. You know, I think someone launching a search engine in Brazil good frigging luck to them at the end of the day. I just don't see that as a major risk. I don't think Microsoft is going to be seriously challenged. You know, decolonization within cloud infrastructure, you know, trying to build your local infrastructure in Brazil or something and take on Azure and AWS and things. I think it's fanciful that's going to happen. But e-commerce is a very intensely competitive game, and it's a very local game. So notwithstanding Amazon's complete domination in the United States, it's had very, very hard to get traction in a lot of other markets. And there are some very, very good businesses who have been building in Southeast Asia and Latin South America that are very, very competitive in the e-commerce sphere. So to me, there's always competition. But if the game's played out, the game is played out. Probably in our hand, I'm probably not as worried about that sort of local competition issue. But, you know, we own some very big platforms in China, and there's a lot of internal competition in e-commerce, let me tell you. A lot's going on in that space. On the threat of regulation, it's omnipresent. You know, it's present everywhere in the world. There are very serious big public policy issues when you get very, very dominant firms occurring, and the regulators are right to look at this at these topics, whether they be privacy or content or purely anti-competitive behaviours. Do we think that they're going to clip their wings? Yeah, they're going to clip their wings. We're less concerned about Microsoft. And it's interesting, in the 2000s, Microsoft was actually the anti-competitive zone where all the regulators were after. But it's largely a large business company. It doesn't really compete in the consumer space. And it's really not in the viewfinder of the regulators. But Alphabet and Facebook and the Chinese tech companies and Amazon and Apple, because of their domination and some of their activities, could be viewed as anti-competitive. Of course, there is going to be regulatory action. And we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And the job is to say, is where do you think the bull's headed, and is it in the price? How much do you think it's going to affect the business model? So we're not losing a lot of sleep at the current prices of the ones we're owned about the regulatory risk. But it's a super, super important issue to get your mind around.
So, Hamish, everyone obviously knows the big names, the Alphabets, Microsofts, et cetera. But are there any lesser known companies that are, you know, you're really finding particularly compelling at the moment?
Without giving away IP. This is a really good fry price. I'm not going to give stock tips about names we don't own, you know, at the end of the day. And there's for various reasons. Obviously, there is genuine competitive reasons for doing that. But there also, if I held something and we hadn't disclosed it yet, and I would disclose it on the thing, and then everyone goes to buy, people could actually say, what would be my motivations for doing that?
You know,
we just can't get caught in that game. But there are things we've recently bought that people may not be that aware of. One is very well known that we've bought, and one is probably really lesser known. The really well known business is Netflix, which is now coming to our portfolio. And again, this is the compound story. This is the 10-year story of how we think that industry is going to play out. And even though this business is now worth $200 billion, you know, we think over the next decade, we're going to make a serious amount of money by being in Netflix. I have no idea where the share price is going in the next 6 months, and that will just be about subscriber growth in the short term. The business that's lesser known, and actually I did an In the Know podcast, which we'll release shortly, with Jeff Sprecher, who is the chairman and chief executive of Intercontinental Exchange, and he truly is one of the great entrepreneurs of the last 20 years. He's one of the great founders. He actually bought a business called Continental Power Exchange, and he bought the business for $1 in 1997. He then listed the business on the New York Stock Exchange in 2005, and for 15 years now, that business since listing has compounded at 17% a year.
Wow.
He now owns the New York Stock Exchange as well, and it's one of the top two exchanges in the world, and he started with $1. It's a little bit cheeky. There was $2 million of debt that he wasn't responsible for, but that has been turned into now a $65 billion US dollar business. And now he's identified, he's effectively looking to digitalize and create a marketplace or an exchange over the whole mortgage industry in the United States to effectively take a very paper and analog process and digitalize the whole application and closing process of mortgages, including linking all lawyers and brokers and banks and everything into a network, and then effectively getting the data from that and digitalizing mortgage data for financial markets. It's absolutely visionary. And the nature of these things, you probably almost get a monopoly if you end. And he's a visionary person. I just don't think this is in the price at all. To be honest, I think this business is probably going to become as big as the whole of the current intercontinental exchange. And he's got such a track record of doing this. So, you know, there is one people probably haven't thought about. They've probably never heard of Jeff Sprecher. And, you know, I put Jeff Sprecher up there with Jeff Bezos. You know, he is one of the true visionaries of an industry. And, you know, maybe people want to watch In the Know. He's going to be on our next episode. He's a remarkable individual.
That's fascinating, Hamish. I've got to ask a follow-up about Netflix. Because, you know, we've watched The Journey. It's a compelling company, but the market is becoming incredibly fragmented and oversaturated, I guess you could say, especially in the US with the number of streaming services. So what's the thesis there for Netflix, and how do you think they sort of continue to separate from the competition?
Yeah, there's ultimately a scale game, and you're right. There's a number of content houses who are now putting out streaming services. Sort of all the content producers are now putting out streaming services there in the United States. You know, the thesis on Netflix is effectively the broadcast television industry and the pay television industry is in terminal decline. In the United States, you know, there's 100 million subscribers to pay television, and they're paying $90+ a month for their pay television. That money is all up for grabs. So, and that's going to zero. Pay television on a global basis is going to disappear because it has a virtuous cycle on the way up. The more users you get in pay television, the more you can pay for the content, and it becomes a virtuous circle. But as soon as you start losing subscribers, you lose the ability to pay for the content. And once you lose to pay for the content, you either have to put your prices up more or you have less content. And that's a vicious cycle. So pay television is going to zero, and all that money is going to head into streaming. Netflix and Disney have such an advantage here in terms of the scale of where their content budgets are. And if you look in the last year, you say the top watched television series in America last year, the top 10, 9 were from Netflix. If you look at the Emmy Awards, 35% of all Emmy Awards were nominated to Netflix. So I think they had 35 or 36 nominations in the Emmys Awards. The next closest content producer had 9, just to put the scale advantage. So they're going to keep scaling up their content on a global basis. And the competitors are outside Disney, they're not doing it global. They're producing US content, okay? And quite a lot of that US content, like The Office and other things, people are signing up for these things at the moment because they know this current content and they want to watch it. But once they've watched what they've watched, I suspect the churn's going to be pretty high on a lot of these others. And if you look at Netflix, some of these series that they've done, if you look at Lupin, that was produced in France for France. So it was a local French one, and it's gone global on Netflix. If you look at what happened, Money Heist, it was a series that was done in Spain for the Spanish audience. If you look at what Narcos was done, that was done for Mexico, and it's gone global. If you look at Bridgerton, that it's been done. If you look at some of their series they've just released this year, stuff you've never even heard of have become massive. 65 million people watching them in the first week. So what I would say is because they've got such a scale in so many markets, they get this massive global. It's just not a US game. The other people are playing out a US game and they're competing for that US staff. Unless they can scale that content budget very, very dramatically and take it global, I think that Netflix and Disney are going to be the center of people's bundles, okay? And because they'll keep producing this content and these hits, you get enormous value out of Netflix. I just don't think people are going to switch off Netflix. And a very simple analysis on Netflix, 200 million subscribers at the moment, slightly more than 200 million. If you look, last year they had a lot of subscribers because of the pandemic. We were sitting in houses. They got 37 million subscribers last year on a global basis. But let's say they average 20 to 30 million. At the lower end of that, they probably get to 400 million sort of households in a decade's time. And then it all comes to pricing. Pay television has average pricing of 6% per annum, which is very unique, 3 times inflation. Even if you do much more modest numbers, they're currently getting about $11 a month on average on global for their Netflix subscription. If you ran it at $20 a month out a decade ahead, If you made that assumption, this would have $100 billion a year of revenue.
Wow.
Maybe their total cost and their content's $50 billion. This is $50 billion pre-tax. Netflix would be worth at least $1 trillion then in the future. So what's happening is whilst all these others are playing, is all this money that's in pay television is all up for grabs. And Netflix and Disney are definitely going to be two people standing. There will people, because they've been spending $90 a month, they're going to sign up to Hulu or sign up to Peacock and others, or Ustan and some other things. They're not going to be, it's not going to be a sole thing, but there's going to be a bundle people put together. And the scale of the content that Netflix has is, I just think in most people's bundle, Netflix is always there. And then it turns into an oligopoly for the next 30 to 40 years. In my opinion. So this is the broadcast television or pay television for the next 30 years, and Netflix is in the center. Disney's it's not as pure play, but Disney's got amazing scaled content as well. And the rest of the guys have got kind of content that people have been watching and want to watch the rest of the series. But how much are they going to scale new content is the real question. Or are people just going to come in and out of them, sign up for a month and then turn the subscriptions off and just watch what they want to watch on some of these other services? It's a scale game, and Netflix is just way in advance of nearly everybody else at the moment. And Reed isn't going to stop. He's going to keep scaling.
Fascinating. So, Hamish, let's move to China. Within Magellan's portfolio, there are some, you know, you've got Tencent and you did have Alibaba, but correct me if I'm wrong on that. And, you know, we've seen the impact that China can have on domestic companies here. Treasury Wine is an example. So how do you think about investing in China more generally? And then we can go from there.
Yeah, it's a really good question. The first question I'd ask is, why are we interested in investing in China? And then how to invest in China and what are the risks? The first thing is, why are we interested in China? You know, China is going to become the largest consumption economy in the world, and betting against China would be a seriously bad thing to do. There are very, very few places in the world where you can get growth in what's enduring growth economically. And China is one of the most exciting places, taking a 10 to 20 year view of the development of their consumption economy. It's driven by urbanization. It's driven by ongoing wealth creation in China. And getting China right over the next 10 to 20 years is a very, very important thing in your investment portfolios. So that's a drive. There is a growth drive sitting there that's going to generate an enormous amount of sort of shareholder wealth. The question is, how do we participate in that? And your question around Treasury Wine Estates is a very good one, because you need a diversified approach because of the risks. And you're right, we own Alibaba and Tencent, two of the best companies in China, but we also have very large investments in Starbucks. We're also invested in LVMH and Estee Lauder. So we've got Western firms who have amazing businesses in China, and those businesses in China are growing at 30% a year, you know, and they're becoming very, very large components of the valuations of those Western firms. But they can get caught up in the geopolitical risks between China and the United States, or China and Europe, or China and Australia at the moment. So you don't want to have all your eggs. You may feel more comfortable about just owning a Starbucks to approach China, because it's easier to speak to the management teams and everything else, and you think the accounts are easier. But there are geopolitical risks if there are tensions between the countries, where China could take action against companies in retaliation to geopolitical issues. And we're seeing that with Australia at the moment. So you just have to be mindful of those. That's one risk in investing in China. The second major risk in investing in China is what I'd call the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party political risks. Have no misapprehension who's in control here. It is the Communist Party. You know, if you go there and you assume something else, you're making an incorrect assumption. From time to time, the Communist Party is going to intervene against businesses if they're doing things that they think are against the party's interests or against the country's interests at the end. And we're seeing that with Alibaba at the moment, after Jack Ma made those comments just before the Ant IPO. I didn't predict Jack would be so stupid to make those comments, but I could predict what the Communist Party would do after he made those comments. You know, so we're aware of those risks. Of course, there are regulatory risks operating in China here, but the regulatory risks, I don't think are fundamentally different to the regulatory risks elsewhere you'd face by owning a very dominant company. Facebook's facing regulatory risks, Alibaba's facing regulatory risks, and you know, they're equally as important in both companies. And the last risk about China is, of course, just reputational risks. They could be about human rights issues or other issues, and you need to think and take, particularly if you're doing things in a public sense like we are, we need to really think about, you know, the companies, how they're operating, what they're doing, where they are, and, you know, are they doing things that really are socially bad or socially good? And we make judgments. Not everyone may want to agree with our judgments on those things, but we think about those issues. So you need to diversify yourself. But I would say getting access to the China growth story is a very, very important thing to get right over the next 5, 10, 20 years. And we're doing it in a multifaceted way at Magellan. We're just not in Tencent and Alibaba. They're meaningful investments. But as I say, we've got big investments in things like Starbucks and LVMH and, you know, Nike, which we don't own, has a fabulous business in China. Apple has a fabulous business in China. Tesla's trying to build a business in China at the moment.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Before we take a look at 2021, we'll just hear from our sponsors. So Hamish, as I said, we'd love to get your views on the outlook for 2021, but also we obviously haven't had a chance to hear your thoughts on the craziness of 2020. We saw the fastest crash and then rebound in the history of the markets, and we'd like you to help us try and separate the signal from the noise for sort of what happened in 2020 and with, you know, unprecedented response from central banks around the world. How are you, or what are you taking from 2020? What were some major lessons?
Yeah, it's interesting what you take from the lessons of 2020 and whether we're witnessing that it appears many people are taking the lessons. The lessons is markets can do extraordinary things. You know, in March, we had one of the most violent sell-offs in you know, if you took over a 30-year period. It was incredibly violent in a very complex situation. Then we saw an extraordinary response of epic proportions by central banks around the world, and then also by governments around the world, in just throwing money at this problem. And then when we sort of hit payday with the vaccines, we saw the strongest market rally in November in 47 years. So, you know, we'd seen sort of staring down the abyss of Armageddon, and we'd seen the absolute euphoria all happen, measured against history, sort of movements, just extraordinary. And what I'd say is, you know, don't let the markets guide you, but don't lose the sight of the facts that markets can react violently in extraordinary ways. And we're in this period now because we've had these vaccines and we're seeing all this sort of government spending around the world, that there's this euphoria in markets. It's like things can't go wrong. And 2020 sort of told you things can really go wrong. But people may have overgot the lesson is, don't worry, the governments will solve this problem. So we don't have to worry about anything here. And I would argue at the moment, I would describe 2021 as the year of living dangerously. I don't think many people feel we're in an environment that there's any danger at all. And I look at this and I think it's one of the most complex sort of situations to assess that I have ever seen in my investing career. And the reason I say that, if you ignore the virus at the moment and you're just saying is what we're doing is we're vaccinating people, that's all going to work, and at some point end of this year or next year, the big question in markets is, are we going to get inflation and what does that mean for monetary policy and could that disturb markets or not? That is a complex equation, thinking about the interest rate markets and whether inflation comes or not. And you know, that doesn't worry. We think about those things all the time. If we really got inflation and in 2022, the Federal Reserve started tightening monetary policy because inflation was coming, hold on to your chairs. That is so ugly for markets, it's not funny. But if we get just not much inflation and rates stay really low with all this stimulus, we're off to the races. So in the absence of the virus, you'd say you just have to answer those questions. I don't think that many people are even thinking about that inflation risk that markets could be in for a really rough ride if that was, I'm not saying that's going to happen, by the way, but it's a very genuine question. But it's much more complex than that at the moment is because of the virus. And people assume that the virus is over because we have these vaccines. And I go, only if it was that simple, and it's very hard putting probabilities, but this virus is mutating and we know it's mutating. So far, if you'd read all the signs, none of the mutations we've seen is likely to evade the vaccines. And that's what we're seeing in South Africa. They're not evading. More people are getting sick, but they're not going to hospital once they've been vaccinated. So everyone goes, oh, well, this is fine. The vaccines are fine. But that's just a picture today. What we don't know over the next few months or 6 months, whether or not we get a mutation that renders these vaccines ineffective. And there have been some very interesting lab studies that, I don't want to go right into them, where exactly that happened in exposing them to antibodies. And I think there's a 50-50 probability that in the next 6 months, these viruses are going to evade the vaccines. And 50-50 is a very polite way of saying, I have no idea. And I don't think anyone else has any idea, but because you're hearing the vaccines are holding up against the variants we see today, everybody's relaxed about it. And then they also hear, don't worry, we can just recode the current vaccines for any mutations. You can't confidently say that unless you know what the mutations are. And some of the mutations that are happening, like this South African mutation, is actually a charge change. So it's gone from positive to negative charge, and it's now repelling the antibodies. So I'm not sure how easy it is to recode for what is known as E484K and make antibodies that will now attach to that zone here, because it's a change in the structure around that part of the spike protein. I don't think it really matters, because we still know that the vaccines are working in other areas to stop getting sick. But the chinks in the armor are being attacked every single day. And depending on that chink, and we know it's going to keep happening. So what happens if we wake up in 3 months' time and now we start getting evidence that the current vaccines no longer work, and we're in this euphoric mode that all these bets have been put on, and then we start finding evidence that maybe it's not so easy to recode for? I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it's absolutely in the viewfinder. If you study the science, the scientists are terrified of this. And yet the markets are just like, let's just get caught up. Let's buy Bitcoin. Let's do all this other stuff and let's ignore all this complexity. Therefore, I'm saying it's the year of living dangerously. And the lesson you asked from 2020 is this could rapidly unravel as quickly as it's raveled up. That's a lesson to take out of 2020 and it will depend upon it. And I say it's a question of nature. Nature will take its course. It will do whatever it does. And we are at the mercy of how nature evolves. And I tell you, I don't know how it's going to evolve. So we're a little bit risk averse here, because we don't know.
Speaking of, you know, unraveling quickly and the year of living dangerously and, you know, not being sure what could happen, one thing that Bryce and I are particularly interested to get your thoughts on are current valuations and how you're thinking about valuation. You know, we had Howard Marks in his recent memo discuss the perils of traditional value investing approach. You know, some of the valuations we're seeing in the US seem very stretched. How are you thinking about current valuations, and then just more generally, how are you approaching that task in 2021?
Well, the first of all, I'd say is in the end, value metrics always matter. You know, as Ben Graham, who wrote The Intelligent Investor, said, you know, in the short term, markets are a voting machine. In the long term, they're a weighing machine. You know, so you can get a huge amount of momentum that has no connection to valuation metrics in the short term, and it's all about storytelling and everything else. But in the end, there's a day of reckoning, and what really matters is valuations. And valuations are very, very simple. It's the cash flow of business can generate between now and judgment day, and you have to discount it back at an appropriate discount rate, and you get the value today. That doesn't mean companies need to earn money today, and that's what Howard Marks was talking about, that you could have businesses like Netflix that are on very, very high P multiples, but we can see a lot of value there because we're making the prediction about what cash flows this business is going to generate in the future, and when we discount it back at sensible rates, we think it's undervalued. And so you could do the same thing on Amazon that's trading at very high multiples, but then there are other businesses that I would like to see people's assumptions they're making on Tesla at the moment of actually doing a discounted cash flow analysis of what market share assumptions they're making, what margin assumptions they're making, and at what time period they're assuming it's going to be earning enough cash flow discounted back today that justifies an $800 billion valuation. It defies any any sort of logic of reality, in my view, of making any sensible assumption. But crowds can move in directions that can inflate these things to extraordinary levels at the end of the day. So ultimately, valuations will come home to roost. In the end, Tesla will reflect its sort of discounted cash flows in the future or whatever that profitability is. There are areas of the market that just look crazy to me, where there's a lot of crowd-like behavior around them. But there are other areas that where we see a lot of value, particularly defensive equities. There's been this massive rotation into this sort of opening up scenario in the stimulus. There's a huge amount of money that's been there. Some of these pre-money sort of you know, cult-like areas where there's a huge amount of money that's gone in, but other things have been left behind. There's some consumer staples that are trading at their lowest multiples in ages, and nothing's changed are there. And, of course, one of the biggest judgments you have to make in that sort of intrinsic value, not only have to try and predict these coupons in the future, and that can be hard here, the other thing is what the interest rate is. And it's very difficult to judge where our interest rate's going to stay at this low level. Buffett describes interest rates as the gravity of market. So as you lower interest rates, assets are worth more in a discounted cash flow basis. And if interest rates go up, assets are worth less. So you have to make that judgment call. But I don't think any of the fundamentals change. It's just over periods of time in the shorter term when things are going up, you go, oh, well, they don't matter anymore. Of course they matter in the end.
Now, Hamish, I'm sure we could listen to you talk about investing all day, but we are nearly reaching the end of our time. We do like to finish with the same final three questions, so we'll move on to them. But before we do, if people want to find out more about yourself and Magellan and your podcast, where should they go? Are there any particular social media that you're particularly active or anything like that?
Yeah, I would say probably the best place. We're pretty old-fashioned. Probably go to our website, then it will direct. We've got a sign up for any stuff. Our In the Know can be found on all the podcast services. We do call out a video stuff as well, but largely that's distributed via. We put that on our YouTube channel, and we put that on our website, and In the Know's on all the podcast services.
You're not on TikTok yet, Hamish?
I'm not on TikTok just at the moment. I need to widen my views. But I notice some of my kids spend hours on it, and I come back hours later, and they're still just flicking the finger, and I'm like, what are you doing?
It's crazy.
Dad, it's really funny.
Yeah, crazy platform.
Yeah, we're dabbling, but trying to figure it out. It's a whole different world out there.
It is.
Yeah. So we'll get to these final three, Hamish. The first one is, do you have any books that you consider must reads?
Well, reading is one of the very important things. I think, you know, we never stop learning, and I could probably give you a list of 100 books that I think are almost must read books, but I won't do that to you. I'll split it very carefully between some investing books and probably non-investment areas where I would suggest people reading. I find fascinating. Of course, the all-time classic is The Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham. It's quite a technical book. It was written in the 30s, but there's two wonderful chapters. One of the chapters is on margin of safety, and the other chapter is about Mr. Market. And those two chapters are probably two of the most important chapters that have ever been written in investing. So you probably don't need to read the whole book, but I'd really suggest you read two chapters out of Ben Graham's Intelligent Investor. Another book that people may not have read that I really love, it was a book called The Wisdom of Crowds by James Surowiecki. And it is, if you want to really understand sort of crowd behavior and what happens, it is a very, very good book. And on the same sort of topic, there was a book that was written a long time ago by Charles Mackay, and we've sort of touched on this a little bit, and it was called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And if you've seen what happened on a GameStop and you're looking what's going on in Bitcoin, and, you know, I had a friend the other day who said, look, his 90-year-old mother, she really wanted my view on Bitcoin because all her friends are talking about it, and she thinks she should take some investment in it. Maybe she should read Charles Mackay's book in that. I think one of the all-time classic sort of collations is another book by Lawrence Cunningham. It's called The Essays of Warren Buffett. So what it's done is taken all the annual reports he's ever written, and it's assembled all the different stuff into different topics. And if you ever want to learn from Warren Buffett, and if you're interested in investing, that's probably one of the greatest collections of a distillation of sort of Warren's thinking over his lifetime, put into one easy consume book. Just outside the investing thing, a book I really loved was a book called The Perfect Weapon. And it was by a guy called David Sanger. And it's really talking about cyber risk in the world and cyber terrorism. It's a great read. But this is one of the great dilemmas of the 21st century, cyber risk in the world. And the last, I'm not going to give you a particular book because there's the numbers here, but if you really want to think about the future of humanity, and it's something I'm fascinated about, and particularly the involving of artificial intelligence, anything that Ray Kurzweil has written on this topic is really worth going to read some of Ray Kurzweil's stuff. But you can listen to Ray on YouTube and other things and get a snapshot of sort of, and it really bends your mind about, you know, where humanity could be headed.
Mm. So the second question, Hamish, is in 60 seconds or less, what's the best company you've ever come across?
Yeah, unfortunately, it isn't Magellan. We're working on it. And it actually isn't even Berkshire Hathaway, I would say. And look, I think it's a really, really difficult question to answer because I think probably the most powerful company that's ever been developed is still evolving. And it's probably hard to really pick which one it is at the moment. Yeah, Amazon would be right up there in the list of probably the most powerful company ever being created. But e-commerce is more competitive. Their advantage is obviously in AWS and their advantage is in infrastructure. They're building out. You know, Alibaba is extraordinary in China. It's sort of an Amazon lookalike. Alphabet probably has a depth behind its research base that no company's seen, but it's difficult to pick which one you would say because they're still work in progress. Mm. They're really some of the most powerful businesses the world has ever seen. Mm. And therefore they're going to evolve and competition's going to evolve. So we're watching a movie, but we haven't got to the end of the movie yet. So I put those top three up there. If I had to pick a company that is just going to endure the test of time, and this person hasn't built all the brands, but they've been put together. LVMH, I think, is extraordinary. You know, these brands have 200-year history. So I think and you're never going to form a new Dom Perignon. You're never going to form a new Louis Vuitton, you know, or a Christian Dior. This is sort of game, set, and match. And if you wanted to win a single brand, it would probably be Hermes as well. Most companies disappear after 30 or 40 years. These brands have been here for 200 years. There's very, very few things who have got duration like that. Bernard Arnault, who's one of the richest guys in the world, has seen this and has put this collection of businesses together in LVMH. But I find it hard. I would be 100% confident that they will never get a rodent next. This company's going to be here in 200 years. It'll probably be LVMH because I just don't think consumer habits are going to change over that period. But which one is going to turn out to be the most powerful business the world has ever seen? You know, I would say maybe Amazon or Alphabet would be in the front of the queue here, but it's still, the game's still playing.
Yeah. Then final question, Hamish, if you're thinking back to, you know, when you were first starting out as an investor, finding a way to buy Wesfarmers shares at a 30% discount, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Well, the first thing I'd say is you need to read. You know, how did I get to that Wesfarmers franked income investment? I asked early on the librarian to put every broker's report that came into Schroders I worked at every single day on my desk, and I probably got 6 inches of broker's reports. And every night at about 10 p.m., I'd sit up at home and I'd read every single broker's report that came in. So there's no substitute for hard work and reading, and you have to have patience in this game. So read. Patience, starting early. This is a compound interest game. If you want to start accumulating knowledge and start investing when you're 50, closer to your retirement, you kind of lost all the advantage of time here. So, you know, unfortunately, you have to spend less than you earn. And I know millennials aren't very good at thinking like that. It's all live today and don't worry about tomorrow. But, you know, if you really want to get ahead financially in life, you want to be a little frugal early on, and you want to start the compounding game early on, and you really need to understand. I used to have, when I was sort of 15 and 16, I used to have compound interest tables up on my wall. I was probably a bit of a nerd. I don't think a lot of people had that. But I was enamored about duration. And I used to go out to 30 years and at different rates and seeing what the multiplier was. And I'm going, I just have to have time. You know, one of my problems in life is I'm running out of time. In my scale of it, I'm 52. But, you know, and if you're young, the advantage you have is time, and you need to understand that time is your real friend when you're young, and don't waste it. Don't waste the time. And the only last thing I'd say is enjoy yourself. You know, just don't get too obsessed about making money and all those things. You have to enjoy yourself in life as well, and enjoy your friends and everything else. And, you know, to some extent, I worked super hard when I was young, and maybe I overworked when I was young. I used to work 7 days a week. I was probably working 12 to 14 hours a day. I did that for years and years and years and years. Maybe I should have taken that foot off that accelerator slightly when I was younger, but I've got no complaints.
Well, Hamish, we truly have enjoyed this conversation with you today. As we said at the start, it's been something we've been looking forward to for a while. So thank you very much for your time. I know our audience certainly would have got a lot out of this conversation. Looking forward to seeing you grow Magellan to be the best business that you've ever seen. And thank you for your time. Hopefully we get to chat to you again at some point this year.
Bryce and Alec, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'd love to speak to you guys again.
Thanks, Hamish.
Thanks for listening to Equity Mates Investing Podcast, a production of Equity Mates Media. Please remember that everything you hear in Equity Mates Investing Podcast is general advice only. The content has been prepared without knowing your personal objectives, specific financial circumstances, or goals. The host of Equity Mates Investing Podcast may maintain positions in the companies discussed. Before considering any investment, please read the product disclosure statement and consider speaking to a licensed financial professional.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.